If the Save America Act is all about voter identification, then why is so much of the debate about transgender athletes? You're listening to SDPB's Dakota Political Junkies. I'm your host, Lori Walsh. Today, we are going to talk with SDSU political scientists David Wiltse and Lisa Hager. And we're going to focus on what U.S. Senator John Thune says is common sense voter identification rules that most people support, but it is taking up all of the debate in the U.S. Senate this week. And if you're tuned in, a lot of that debate is either about transgender athletes or healthcare for transgender youth. We wanted to know why that was. David Wiltse is a professor of political science in the School of American and Global Studies at South Dakota State University. We're going to begin here with Lisa Hager. She's associate professor of political science also at SDSU.
This is just a good example for everyone about how the Senate allows non-germane amendments to be inserted into legislation that they're hearing. So on the House side, we definitely have a much more structured environment. We have a rules committee that's making determinations about what the amendment environment will even look like on the floor, whether we're going to have a closed process with no amendments, or we're going to have it be more open, or even really anything in between, to be quite honest. But on the Senate floor, we don't have similar sorts of structure. And so that's why you can have a lot of unpredictability, both in terms of whether non-germane amendments or amendments that don't actually pertain to the primary bill at hand. And just, you can have a filibuster and you name it. So I was talking to my students yesterday in my U.S. Congress class, and I told them, here is the perfect prime example of non-germane amendments that we're seeing on the Senate side. And why in this class we are simulating the House side, because I don't know how I would deal with you all trying to put in non-germane amendments and debate one thing for forever. We would never get to a floor vote of any kind.
All right. So the answer to the question is because they can.
Correct.
Essentially, it's allowed in the rules. Now, why, Dave Wiltse, what's the strategy? Why would you want to? Because, well, as Lisa just said, it could derail the whole thing forever.
Well, it could. But what I think is going on here is, like Lisa said, the rules of the Senate allow for this to turn into kind of a hodgepodge of whatever they need. And what we're seeing is Trump and his allies in the Senate just kind of defaulting to the things that they know can really electrify their base and work off of the identity of their supporters that they have found successful in the past. So they know that this transgender issue or this set of transgender issues is something that plays well with their base. So they throw that in. They attach it to a bill that is ostensibly about illegal immigrants voting in American elections. They know that plays well to their base. So they throw that in. And the Senate just makes it a perfect forum for this to take place. And when it comes to the why, it really is about President Trump trying to rally some support that he has been losing in the last few months because of all the various things that have been going on, whether it be with Iran, whether it be with ICE and DHS, and all the other little fires that have been dragging him down over the past several months.
Is it working? And how do we know, how do we measure success from a strategy like this? What is John Thune, for example, and I'm not asking you to get inside his brain, but what is he looking for to see the measures of success? Lisa, do you have thoughts on how you determine whether that is working and how long you keep it going?
That's a good question. So I think to a certain extent, they're also forward thinking about trying to not lose as badly as the Republicans will lose when it comes to the midterms. And I say that because most people are going to say, well, how do you know that they're going to lose at the midterms? History, data. Data tells us that every time at the midterms, the president's party is going to lose seats. So we already know the House is most likely going to be the one that flips. But right now, I think the Senate is somewhat in play where I don't think we're necessarily going to see a change in party control. But as things continue to develop across all of those different issue areas you talked about, the Democrats are going to see more in play than maybe they did even a few months ago. And so I think some of this is to try to eliminate that damage. But at the same time, I think some folks don't necessarily think about there's always this loss of seats at midterms, even though like the most recent one where we haven't seen that was with George W. Bush after 9/11. Mm. But, you know, in general, I think politicians are still kind of thinking, how can we try to look toward the midterms?
Yeah. I mean, we can count on a single hand the number of times that the president's party has actually gained in the midterms. This is a pattern that goes back decades.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I can't remember the like second most recent example.
Yeah.
But the Bush one
they're
is
there.
The most
I think there was one during Clinton's, right after Monica Lewinsky stuff and the impeachment.
I think so.
But again, that was a one-off, very rare. And complicating that for the Republicans is the fact that it's not just the fact that the president is facing a midterm. The things that are underlying that pattern are presidential popularity and the macroeconomic condition of the country at the time, because that's how people form their opinions of the administration and the president. So
it's the economy, stupid.
Yeah, okay. To an extent. I mean, it's not as straightforward as a lot of people think, but it is a factor. And, you know, they are trying to hedge against what could be some serious losses. I mean, Lisa's spot on. We're probably not going to see the Senate flip. That would require some really weird things happening.
Mm-hmm.
But it is very likely that the House will go the Democrats' way. And they're trying to pull out all the stops, shore up as much of their electoral coalition as possible to get them in as good of a position as they can get out of what could be a bloodbath. And ultimately, as far as just kind of assessing whether or not this works and what they're looking for, we'll just have to look to the election, because ultimately this is about managing their electoral coalition.
So is there any good faith debate about voter identification happening at all here? Or is this all just no?
Mm-mm.
Okay.
None. I mean, this is a manufactured issue. This is something that is just straight out of the president's ramblings and his rantings about 2020. This is not a problem. This is not something that happens very often. And when it does, it has zero effect on outcomes. The United States is actually pretty good at this. Even though we have a very, very decentralized system of voting registration and running elections, we have remarkably few instances of out-and-out voter fraud and impersonation at the polling place.
Meanwhile, the news is really all about Iran. You know, the president originally said this conflict could last as long as 5 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's at stake for him if it goes longer?
Well, it's his credibility and the assessment that people are making about his judgment of jumping into this conflict in the first instance.
Mm.
They've had a terrible public relations effort on this. Zero effort made on the diplomatic front, zero effort made in terms of the PR game to the American people, explaining why they went in, what our long-term strategic goals are. It's just a mess. Obviously, when it comes to military tactics and our capacities, we're all over it. I mean, there's no question that we have superiority here, but tactics only get you so far in the absence of strategy. And there is no articulation of a long-term strategy here. I mean, the closest we've seen to this right now is Trump insisting that Iran reopen the Strait of Hormuz and pressuring them for that one action right now, which basically is they're trying to solve a problem that wasn't a problem until we went into this incursion 3 weeks ago, which makes no sense. And, I mean, this is why the old phrase from Song Shu, was something like, tactics in the absence of strategy is the noise before defeat.
Hmm.
And there's no sense of what our strategic interests are and what our long-term goals in the area are. And you can have the best military in the world, which we clearly do, but absent those kind of long-term goals, it's a pointless exercise.
Yeah. Lisa, what would you add to that? And how does the president get to some semblance of victory?
So what I've been seeing so far is it is all about Trump's credibility, and he's losing Republican support because he campaigned on no new wars. And a lot of what I'm seeing is, so what was Venezuela? What is going on in Iran? And there is definitely an age difference where there's more support for Trump among the older Republicans than there is amongst the younger Republicans. But I think that's really one of the issues with his credibility, is he's causing rifts within the Republican Party itself with respect to this, which, you know, I don't think is going to have a big impact necessarily on the midterms per se because of everything we already talked about. But I do think this could become a more divisive issue within the party as time wears on. If this continues to go for weeks on end, and like Dave said, there's no clear goal or long-term viewpoint of what are we trying to accomplish here.
Yeah.
You know, as far as like when he can declare victory, you know, that was a good question, even as you were emailing us saying we should talk about this issue. And, you know, as I was kind of thinking, I'm like, you know, what is kind of, you know, a good way he can declare victory? And I just kind of started poking around, looking at what a lot of others were saying. And, you know, it just kind of seems like the consensus, and I wouldn't necessarily disagree, but I just wanted to make sure I'm not the only person just coming up with something out of thin air, which was a lot of just Iran basically has to be completely decimated in all, you know, shapes and forms, which I think is, you know, happening already. Yeah. But there was some discussion about really kind of trying to show other world powers just how prominent the United States can be when they want something to happen. And some of that being with respect to maybe like if China would try to do something to Taiwan, or, you know, the same kinds of things we're seeing with Russia and Ukraine. So I think that's really how Trump declares quote unquote victory, is just showing what the U.S. military capability is.
Yeah, my sense is probably the most likely thing he would declare victory over is reopening the strait. And then he can declare his victory, come home, and be done with it. And we know he's not in this for the long term. He has no interest or patience for any kind of occupation or, you know, actually changing the regime in Iran. They're obviously decapitating them in terms of personnel, but when it comes to actually changing the internal politics and the system of governance there, he's got no interest in that. So I think he'll pick some short-term, immediate goal like that, that he can declare his prowess in terms of negotiation, cut a deal, and bring folks home.
But Lisa, what you said, it sounds like a parade, only with everything full throttle. And that's why he had a military parade on his birthday, was to show what the great power of American military might was. It makes me uncomfortable to think that part of this is an extension of the desire to demonstrate what we're capable of.
Yeah, I mean, I just kind of get that sense of that's somewhat of how Trump engages, even diplomatically at times, is there's always that to fall back on. And if ultimately we can't get something to happen, our threat is to use military force. So I think that's just sort of an overarching theme with him. And this is one of those examples where that is what came to fruition, although I just don't think there was as much diplomatic efforts taking place prior to the military force.
Yeah.
Well, the diplomatic effort just wasn't there, largely because the diplomatic corps is a skeleton of what it once was. I mean, this, in so many ways, just showed the diplomatic weakness of the United States right now. We just don't have the personnel. We don't have anyone close to the president or the president himself that is experienced in diplomacy, that has the experience and the knowledge necessary to advise this guy in a smart manner. When you surround yourself by sycophants who are doing nothing but saying yes, sir, when he acts on these impulses, this is going to be the result. And we know he acts almost entirely on impulse. He has just visceral reactions to what he sees going on, and then he jumps in without any foresight whatsoever. And I mean, he was genuinely surprised that the Iranians closed the Strait of Hormuz. And if you know anything about the history there, Iran shut down the Strait of Hormuz. Iraq has shut down the Strait of Hormuz. That is one of the first things that they're going to do because they know that that choke point is so critical to the world economy, and it can have an immediate effect on both the aggressor and everybody else in the world as a consequence of it. So it just shows that they don't take this seriously, and they don't have serious personnel there anymore. In this first administration, he did. He had a number of generals who would have put the brakes on this right away. He had people in the State Department that would have said, sir, this is not a good idea. Here are the consequences. But that's just how he operates.
So that brings us to the idea of if this reminds you of his first term in other ways. There are some definite differences. Are there ways that you feel this is familiar to his first term? I'm thinking specifically of the pandemic and how he had all these, you know, policies going, and then something major, although this one is his own doing, derailed and became the biggest news story.
Yeah. Well, even in the pandemic, you know, we still had a CDC and a Department of Health and Human Services that was staffed with professionals that knew what they were doing. And we're able to at least steer him and the rest of the administration in some productive ways. I mean, let's not forget how miraculous the Operation Lightspeed was and how quickly we developed that vaccine.
Yeah.
I don't think that would be possible now in this administration simply because of how we've eviscerated our public health sector of that kind of expertise. And I think we see some parallels in the diplomatic corps now. The very fact that Marco Rubio is serving both as Secretary of State and National Security Advisor is a big red flag. I mean, first of all, these are very different positions. It should not be a position that's fused in this way. But it's telling that there aren't people willing to serve in these positions who are coming from the experience we need in our diplomatic corps.
All right. Watching John Thune coming on television again and again has me wondering if he is a presidential candidate in the future. Is this a way for him to move forward? Any thoughts on John Thune for president?
I kind of kicked this idea around as you posed it originally. And, you know, I struggle with whether I think he will appeal to all Republicans, especially given there is this chunk of the Republican Party that is Trump all the way, and he can do no wrong. And despite everything we've been saying, where he acts on impulse and isn't thinking things through, that group thinks that he has this big grand master plan and it will all somehow come together. So I don't think that there's going to be as much appreciation across the Republican Party for someone who's a more institutionalist, someone who is willing to bring the parties together. When bipartisanship is a dirty word, I just have a feeling Thune will not appeal. However, as things continue to somewhat sour with the Trump administration, you know, Vance is going to possibly be impacted by this. Rubio is another person who I thought could come out of the Republican Party as a possible candidate. You know, maybe that does leave room for someone like a John Thune to at least throw his hat in the ring and see what happens, because I don't really know how deep the bench is on the Republican Party side beyond some of these folks who are involved in the Trump administration for the presidential nomination.
Yeah, it's an open question as to you know, what the long-term effect of Trump is going to be on the Republican Party and the factions that make up the Republican Party. I could very easily see a scenario once Trump leaves the scene, and honest to God, who knows when that's going to come. They are selling Trump 28 paraphernalia. I don't know if this is just to bilk his supporters or if they are serious about this. But this is a place where people like Thune need to come up and say no. So absent Trump in the Republican coalition, perhaps someone like Thune, more institutionally oriented, has a place. But who knows? My sense is they're going to be dealing with this rift in their party for a few elections because nobody is going to fill Trump's shoes in the way that direct that part of the Republican coalition in the way that Trump did.
Yeah.
He is very personalized in his coalition management, and no one seems to be able to replicate that. Mm-hmm. Nobody can get that same feel that Trump has for the party right now. So who knows? Thune would probably be best served for himself, for South Dakota, and maybe even the country if he just stays put as Republican leader in the Senate, because we need good institutionalists like him from both parties in that position.
And that is our conversation for today. We hope that it served you. David Wiltse is professor of political science in the School of American and Global Studies at South Dakota State University. Lisa Hager is associate professor of political science, also there at SDSU in Brookings. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thanks for listening.